Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to Madison's Notes, the official podcast of Princeton University's James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions. I'm your host, Annika Nordquist. Today, I'm so excited to welcome to the show a Madisonian, Dr. Aaron Zubia, a 2019 to 2020 Thomas W. Smith Postdoctoral Research Associate here at the James Madison Program. Now, he's an assistant professor at the Hamilton Center at the University of Florida, where he specializes in moral and political philosophy of the Scottish Enlightenment. Today, we're here to discuss his new book, The Political Thought of David Hume, The Origins of Liberalism and the Political Imagination. David Hume is a thinker of extreme importance and no small amount of controversy, so we're really lucky to have Aaron here to guide us through the intricacies of his thought, why it's so foundational to the way that we think about politics today, but also places where many think that his thought falls short. So with no further ado, I'm so excited to welcome back to the Madison Program, Dr. Aaron Zubia. Aaron, welcome to the show. I'm so excited to have you on.
Thank you, Annika. It's great to be here.
So when I read your book, I mean, when you delve into some of these philosophers, I think sometimes you're like, wow, this is really edgy. This is really provocative. And sometimes you're like, wow, this I feel like people generally agree with now. And when I was reading about Hume, I'm curious if you'll disagree, but I definitely felt like it was in the latter category, especially a lot of the, you know, religion in the public sphere, a lot of those kinds of issues.
Yeah.
So when one is getting into Hume, I mean, A, do you agree that a lot of it has kind of been accepted broadly and isn't as provocative? And if that is the case, then why is it worthwhile to really dig into Hume?
Very good question. I do think that Hume is one of these major thinkers whose ideas are still very present with us. And I think many people today reading Hume, I mean, I think Hume's view has prevailed in in many ways. Now, in his day, he was very controversial. So I think contemporary readers, post-Enlightenment readers who are taking a look at Hume, well, you know, he's pretty skeptical. He separates morality from religion. He speaks in utilitarian or contractarian terms. People on both the left and the right can find something in Hume that they agree with. Yet in his day, some people saw him as the inheritor of, you know, the mantle of Montesquieu. And some people thought, this is a radical skeptic who, like Hobbes and Mandeville, has a kind of doctrine that will lead to license, that will lead to the degradation of our political life. And that someone like Abigail Adams, John Adams' wife, said, all right, Charles is going to Harvard, our kids are going to Harvard, we can't have these kids reading these licentious authors like Mandeville and Hume because they're, you know, irreligious and licentious. And if we have our young people reading them, they're not going to be ready. They're not going to have the tools. They're not going to be equipped to respond to them. So part of what I'm doing is looking at those early criticisms of Hume and seeing that, you know, counter to some contemporary beliefs, you know, the critics of Hume weren't so crazy. In many cases, they were defending the Socratic, classical philosophical tradition and the Christian tradition that we've, in large part, turned away from. So if we want to see how, you know, our public discourse, the modern political imagination has shifted away from a classical Christian foundation, Hume is a perfect thinker to read and to wrestle with.
I want to definitely ask about Socrates and the Socratic method, but just quickly, because I can't resist, why would one be very pro-Montesquieu but still anti-Hume? Because from my relatively surface-level reading of Montesquieu, it seems like he's pretty skeptical as well.
Yeah, that's right. Now, Montesquieu and Hume had letters. They exchanged letters back and forth from 1748 after Montesquieu published The Spirit of the Laws. Hume read it, and Hume was very complimentary of Montesquieu. And until Montesquieu's death in 1755, they did exchange letters. And they had a similar translator, the translator of Hume's public political discourses of 1752, a set of economic essays were translated by Montesquieu's translator. And he thought that Hume, like Montesquieu, was a worldly, cosmopolitan, sophisticated thinker. And so you're right. It wasn't the same figures who looked at Montesquieu and Hume askance, right? You either, I mean, they're both very similar thinkers. And I mean, in the American founding, Montesquieu and Hume, two of the most quoted writers in the Constitutional Convention, in the Federalist Papers. So this is, I mean, this is another interesting thing. Hume's political conservatism, there's certainly some aspects of conservatism there, is accompanied by a kind of philosophical radicalism. And that is an odd juxtaposition.
So talking about Socrates, I mean, it's kind of interesting because so much of your book is trying to really make the case that Hume is in conversation with the ancients. And I think a lot of people don't necessarily think about or have an understanding of the fact that not all the ancients loved Socrates.
That's right.
So, I mean, talk a little bit about, I mean, what actually did Hume dislike about Socrates? And what is kind of the contrary history of the ancient world in which a lot of people didn't like Socrates or Socratic thought?
Yeah, that's right. That's, yeah, this is so interesting. I mean, we think about the classical tradition and we root it in Socrates. I mean, Francis Hutcheson in the Scottish Enlightenment, you know, it's common to look back at Socrates, his manner of questioning, his bringing philosophy down to earth, to the streets, to the houses of individuals, to discuss virtue and vice, good and evil, right? This is the philosophical tradition where our moral and political philosophic tradition begins. And Epicurus, the 3rd century BC Hellenistic philosopher, he said, "I spit on Socrates and all mention of the noble or the good." So you have this line from Socrates to Plato to Aristotle to the Stoics and Cicero. These are all people who espouse a kind of natural law, a kind of natural justice, and Epicurus is having no part of it. He grounds morality in pleasure and in utility. And so, and Epicurus is the great foil. I mean, the one that Cicero and the church fathers through the medieval period, I mean, Epicurus is the target of so much of their moral discourse. And matter of fact, in the Jewish tradition, beginning with Maimonides, I think the Hebrew word for heretic comes from the word Epicurus, the founder of the sect. And that's because one thing that Epicurus did is he severed the link between morality and religion. He denied that there was any divine providence. He denied that the gods created any kind of moral or natural law. And I mean, so this seems so distant to us. I mean, insofar as like, why are we talking about Epicurus instead of someone else, someone more modern? But one thing I think we can learn from the Epicureans is that it's a moral endeavor. It seems to be, first and foremost, a moral endeavor. So they look very modern. They're empiricists. They start with sense perception. And, you know, they follow the phenomena where it leads in order to find, you know, routine occurrences, uniform operations of nature. And this seems very modern. But Epicurus's goal is the freedom from fear of the gods and freedom from the fear of death. So the ends of Epicurean science are predetermined, right? We know to eliminate fear of the gods, we have to ensure that there's no divine activity, right? It's all just natural occurrences. In order to secure ourselves, you know, from freedom of death, we have to get rid of the illusion of an afterlife. So if this Epicurean science seems to be, you know, morally driven, a matter more of the heart than of the head, perhaps. And so even though we think of this as such a you know, an ancient viewpoint, I mean, it's worthwhile thinking about how much of our science, you know, comes to predetermined ends, how much of it is a matter of the will. And especially thinking of our society today, our public discourse, our political imagination, you know, we act as if there's no divine providence. And in the contractarian tradition, the utilitarian tradition, which is the two strands of liberalism, we assume that there's no natural law, and we ground our public morals in what can be agreed on. Well, that's an Epicurean view, one that is founded on the Epicurean denial of divine providence and natural law. So, I mean, you know, how much of that is necessity, like we are driven here by science? How much of that is, you know, perhaps prudence, or how much of it is downright willfulness, avoiding some sort of natural law that is above and beyond consent that we don't think we can or don't think we ought to align with?
It's very interesting the way that you put it as a matter of the heart versus a matter of the head, because I think, I mean, a lot of the arguments that you present, or Hume presents, Hume is saying in your book, are very much associated with kind of the more new atheist strand, which is extremely like, this is completely in our head, we've thought it through. And then kind of the way right. You're presenting it now is this is actually a matter of the heart. I know this is kind of a vague question, but can you dwell a little bit more on that? Because those seem like they're kind of two contrary positions about what exactly the status of those kind of views are.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I think, so one thing that Hume is doing in his time period, I mean, when he's thinking about religion, he's thinking about most of the popular religion in his day as false religion, mm-hmm. as superstitious or enthusiastic, and these lead to bad views for Hume. He thinks superstition leads to the theory of divine right kingship, which leads to the view of passive obedience, where you have to obey the monarch no matter what, maybe particularly one hereditary monarch, the Stuarts, and this leads to Jacobite rebellions in the 1740s. Then you have enthusiasm, which he associates with a kind of Puritan extremism. I have a direct line to God, and we ought to have a bottom-up democratic church and state governance. So this is, you know, this grounds a lot of revolutionary fervor and reactionary fervor. And, you know, Hume says these are species of false religion. There's a species of true religion, he says, in a couple of places, and this is essentially good morals. So Hume passes himself off as someone who thinks that beliefs don't really matter, like good living matters. And this arose partly in the early modern period because of hypocrisy on the part of Christians. So Pierre Bayle, a French skeptic, he says, I see a lot of Christians espousing morals. They don't abide by them. Matter of fact, most of the Christians I know are immoral. And then Hume, or Bayle says, atheists, I know a lot of atheists who seem to respect contracts, you know, not to harm others. And so he was led to the conclusion that beliefs don't really matter that much. And Hume went a step further and said, actually, some beliefs, religious beliefs, seem harmful. He said the best religionist I know, he said this toward the end of his life, is, you know, less virtuous than, you know, the worst heretic I know, basically. So what is the relation, you know, between the head and the heart? Hume sort of, he wants to say beliefs don't matter so much. So like in political life, like that's why he can be considered as kind of a conservative. He sort of excludes that radical philosophizing from the political realm. But then at the same time, you know, he says, you know, like religious and scholastic views actually are impediments to sound philosophy, impediments to peaceful living. There's this puzzle here. I mean, Hume, who wants to say that beliefs don't matter so much that we can just live in common life together and live peacefully, at the same time, he popularizes political science and says, you know, any book with, you know, scholastic metaphysics should be thrown into the fire. I mean, so what is it? Do beliefs not matter, or do they? And if they don't matter, why is Hume so concerned with, you know, publicizing his views? He considered himself a resident ambassador from the learned realm to circles of polite conversation. So it seems to me that even Hume is testifying to the importance of the pursuit of truth and the importance of sound beliefs for good governance. And, you know, I personally think, like, for Hume, he had some great personal dislike for both austere moralists, like people like Neo-Stoics, who promoted a kind of harsh, almost kind of ascetic morality, like a martial discipline, the kind of Stoic or Spartan virtue. He did not think that should be revived. He also really disliked the Christian austere moralist, monkish virtues, he called them, of humility, self-denial. He didn't like these either. And then he presented virtue as someone with lively charms who wants to encourage frolic and gaiety and play, right? So, I mean, this desire to be at ease and not to be overly pressured by austere systems, stern systems. I mean, this seems to be like where Hume is temperamentally, dispositionally. And I mean, I think there's something to that. Like, we don't like to, you know, be at the dinner table with people who are going to lecture us all the time. Hume recognized this. He didn't lecture other people at the dinner table, which is why he was so popular throwing, you know, fancy dinner parties and cooking and being a warm, pleasant figure to be around. Now, this is a long answer, but I think is really interesting here is separating these groups, right? The stern stoical group, the stern Christian group, and then this sort of lighthearted, perhaps Epicurean group. Later on, you know, half a century later, Jeremy Bentham, the English utilitarian, he's going to take these categories and agree with Hume that these are live categories of thought representing real groups of people in society. And he says, what are we going to base our public law on? Are we going to base it on that kind of stern, neo-stoic, martial republican discipline, which doesn't seem to fit in a commercial age, a luxurious age? Are we going to base our public law on a Christian religious ethic that, if abided by, also seems like it would obstruct, you know, the pursuit of luxury and ease? Or are we going to base it on a kind of a determination of what is most pleasant and what is most useful in material terms? And that is the kind of reasoning, I think, that someone like Bentham engages in, someone like Hume engages in, and a lot of folks in the liberal tradition engage in. And of course, Bentham said, that Socrates and Plato were talking nonsense. He said that natural law was nonsense on stilts. And then John Stuart Mill later on says, look, the morality based on utility, it goes back to Epicurus, it goes back to Horace, it goes back to Hume and Bentham. So, right, this book is called The Political Thought of David Hume, and he is a central figure. Yet it's really a search into, what made the modern political imagination. I think Hume is central here, but right, this Epicurean tradition, which precedes Hume and follows Hume, right, it makes a difference for how we're going to organize our society, think about our society, form our legal structure. And so, you know, you can say philosophy doesn't matter, but it seems to matter quite a bit. I mean, these are all philosophical issues when you get down to it.
Yes, and as I let you know before I've been following this because my interest is in the ancient world, I've been following this avidly, but I don't know if everyone knows about it. They've just started unrolling some of the scrolls from Herculaneum, and it's all like Epicurean texts. It's what's old is literally new again.
You mentioned this to me, and so I looked it up, and yeah, I can't believe it. And I think I saw that they're using AI tools to translate them, right? And I think they've only done like 5% of one manuscript out of so many manuscripts.
Yeah.
They're in the early stages, but...
But it's all Epicurean.
Yeah, it is. That's
right.
We were
like, maybe a lost dialogue of Aristotle, but no. We can't have nice things, apparently. But yeah, one more question about, because as you observe, I think it's so important and so central to kind of properly understand Epicureanism, to understand the whole rest of this. Even in the ancient world, people will poke fun of Epicurus a little bit. I mean, it's sort of a frequent kind of tongue-in-cheek criticism that it's all basically about indulging yourself. And it's funny because I think, I mean, as you kind of open your book talking about this, but a lot of the same criticisms were levied at Hume. And you could even make a lot of the same, people often do make a lot of the same criticisms about our kind of present culture, which is super focused on instant gratification.
Right.
So is that a fair understanding of what Epicureanism is, or is there something kind of deeper to understand about the relationship that one should have with self-gratification?
Yeah, great question. Epicurus would be very happy for us to vindicate him a little bit. And there were efforts, you know, in the 17th century in England to do precisely this, to vindicate Epicurus against his critics. Because, I mean, he did think it was not an active sensual pleasure that one ought to maximize in order to experience tranquility. Right, because that's, you know, and, you know, you eat too much, you drink too much, you don't exercise enough. Like, you know, this is not going to be good. That's obvious. So he did regard absence of pain more than pursuit of active pleasure as a standard. This absence of pain and the incorporation of mental pleasures, too, which, you know, remain with you even when the body goes. Now, critics like Cicero and the church fathers would say this is just, it's not a robust enough standard to maintain virtuous living, because you will have people like, you know, the ancient Roman Petronius, who's just, you know, who does just seem to be a wild man, just this wildly hedonistic character. And similarly, in 17th century England and France, you have people trying to vindicate Epicurus, but then you have, you know, the age of the Restoration in England, which was the most, you know, hedonistic, you know, at least age in the court of the Stuart monarch. So, it's hard to stop, and I think that is the ultimate criticism. Pleasure and the absence of pain is just not a thick enough conception, just not a robust enough conception to ground happiness. Now, I mean, it's very important to distinguish between ancient Epicureanism and modern Epicureanism in another way. The ancients, you know, wanted to conform to nature. So Epicurus was an atomist who thought atoms combined together to form the things in nature that we experience. And he thought similarly, society forms by a group of isolated individuals who come together and agree not to harm each other for the sake of peace. And so there's the idea of conforming to nature. This is how it happens in nature, so this is what we ought to do. Whereas more modern interpreters of Epicurus, and this is what makes them modern, they think that nature is no friend. Nature is a harsh stepmother. Nature is not something to be replicated. It is something to be conquered, to be changed. And so this conventionalism, right, this idea that we make our own political life, our own law, we make justice, the laws of justice. This is what the moderns do. It's more a turn away from nature than an effort to subordinate oneself to or to reflect nature. And so this is where, you know, modern Epicureanism, if you can call it that, is different than ancient Epicureanism.
Wow, that's very interesting, especially because, I mean, the ancients had so much more to fear from nature than we do. So it's interesting that we took that turn. And it's also interesting because, I mean, I guess my initial response to that would be, well, in the modern world, we have so many ways to, I mean, artificially with drugs or whatever, kind of achieve instant gratification that are like so unnatural, right? That are fundamentally fake. Which Epicurus wouldn't, and you know, one I kind of wonder like how Epicurus would have responded had that been a possibility in the ancient world.
Yeah, and I mean, this is, you know, the luxury debates in the 18th century. You know, there's a new commercial society in England, and you have growth in international trade, more merchants. Hume is definitely thinking about a kind of, you know, he's thinking about city life, you know, more than he's thinking about country life. And, you know, the luxuries they were talking about then are definitely things we take for granted, right? So like the Neo-Stoics would say, let's not get carried away here with all this tea and coffee and these spices and this fine china and things like that. And
I'm here with my huge mug of tea. I'm like, oh yeah, get rid of the tea.
And I'm sitting here with coffee and I'm like, I don't want to get rid of this. Or you're thinking, I mean, Edinburgh was very, I mean, it was filthy in the mid 18th century and early 18th century. And with, you know, these efforts to clean up the city, to engage in trade, to, you know, have a mentality that's focused on making life, you know, like easier and more comfortable.
Right.
I mean, that largely succeeded. So it is easier from this perspective, from this day and age where I enjoy, you know, hot showers and, you know, like there's not, you know, there's no urine and feces in the street, right? Because people are just dumping it out. And it stinks. I mean, Edinburgh was a stinky place. Right. So easy for me to say, well, we should, you know, back to nature. And I mean, I've never had a farm, you know, I've never, it takes hard work. But at the same time, like what is all this technology? What is all this artifice and convenience doing to us? I mean, you know, in many ways making us weaker and in many ways giving us more time to engage in hobbies and things like that. But yeah, I mean, these are the kinds of questions that I think arise for anybody who wants to laud the ancients, you know, and bemoan the trajectory of modern life with its instant gratification. I have a love-hate relationship with modernity. And so, I mean, it's worth thinking about. But I think there are certainly tools, like tools, moral resources, moral philosophical resources provided by the classical tradition, which I would say is the Socratic tradition, that could help us more, you know, at this time than the Epicurean one, which, you know, just doesn't stop us from, you know, obsession with instant gratification.
Doesn't provide no cushion of protection. Against the risks. I wonder if you can unpack a little bit more. I mean, the word virtue has come up a couple times. And it's funny because I think on the face of it, you're like, well, I'm against virtue. You're like, oh my God, he's going to rob me. You know, I can't hang out with this guy. But at the same time, I don't know, society writ large, it seems to me really has adopted a lot of kind of Hume's critiques of the idea of virtue. So explain a little bit what they are. You know, what are the two kind of positions here? We like virtue, we don't need virtue.
Yeah, that's contemporary scholars debate Hume's ethic. How do we conceive of it? Is it a utilitarian theory? Is it a virtue theory? Because Hume does use the language of virtue. He does not use the language of the noble. So the three categories that you can find in Aristotle's ethics and that you can find throughout the philosophical tradition, even in Locke, right? The noble, the pleasant, and the useful. And Cicero's categorization of these in Book 3 of On Duties is, you know, whatever is useful is not necessarily noble, but whatever is noble is always useful. And so that the idea is there's some kind of fitness, there's some sort of, right, like natural law, there's some sort of, you know, human nature that inclines us to participate, say, in particular communities, family, society, church or synagogue, right? Like we're religious, political, and moral beings, and right, there's a particular trajectory for human nature, like particular needs. And Hume discards this notion of fitness or nobility, and he just relies on the useful and the pleasant. And so this is one reason he can present virtue as, you know, this figure that is full of charms, right? Like not scary. It's not too hard. Hume says, you know, we respond like he's not a moral rationalist. He's a sentimentalist, which means he grounds the origin of virtue and vice in feeling. So, right, we react to a particular characters with, you know, with a positive feeling based on their usefulness or their agreeableness. And Hume really, I mean, he describes a perfect virtuous character as someone who's a, you know, kind father, a generous friend, an enjoyable companion. I mean, it's a kind of different presentation of what virtue is, and some scholars have called Hume's second inquiry, the inquiry concerning the principles of morals, as, you know, a kind of a handbook of commercial morals. Like, this is the morality of a polite commercial society, right? So you can see, you know, it's not like finger wagging. It's basically, you know, laugh easily, engage, you know, have good hygiene, and be industrious, you know, improve your life and the life of others. And so, I mean, these are good things. Don't get me wrong. I've been around smelly people, not fun. I've been around people who are not easy laughers. That can also be a challenge. And that's one thing. I mean, so Hume is reacting to, responding to excess, what he thinks is a kind of excessive, you know, fear of the afterlife, or kind of excessively airy or ethereal metaphysics. So he wants to bring things down to earth. And, you know, in some ways that's called for. But he's also perhaps not taking fully into account that his civilization derived from precisely those classical Christian morals. So there's this stockpile, right, of norms and practices influenced by those very views that he despises. And once you have the outgrowth of I was calling it a secular society, and then I had a professor at Columbia, he said, yeah, call it, it's atheistic, you know, that's what it is. And I said, yeah, you know, you're right. And so this is, you have the outgrowth, or the, you know, the development of an atheistic society, and then what are you left with? And so I think, you know, our time is not Hume's time.
Right.
And so, you know, just as Hume was responsive to his circumstances, we need to be responsive to our circumstances. And so we can learn from how he responded to his circumstances, but, you know, I think to emulate the best of Hume, it calls us not to follow him. He wasn't following anybody, you know, he was against a kind of dogmatism. Well, we can respond to our circumstances freely in the pursuit of truth. I think that's what's called for.
Hmm. This is a bit of a tangent, but I kind of wonder, as I was reading about virtue, or Hume's thoughts on virtue, I thought about beauty, which is, for a lot of conservatives, kind of in a similar category of, like, conservatives say, this is really important, this is objective, and liberals view it as subjective or sort of unimportant. But from an Epicurean standpoint, one would think that, you know, beauty, because it causes kind of immediate pleasure, might take a little bit of a higher priority. Does Hume have a similar relationship with beauty, or does he talk about it at all?
He does. So he has an essay that, for those interested in aesthetic theory, it's well worth reading. It's Of the Standard of Taste, and it appears in his essays, Moral, Political, and Literary. And he associates moral taste, moral feeling, with aesthetic taste and feeling. So similar to the way in which morality for Hume is grounded in feeling or taste, so is the aesthetic sort of sensibility. Hume does go a little bit toward the subjective side, because he says, you know, it's nothing in the object that is, you know, virtuous. Like, virtue is not in the external object. Beauty is not in the external object. It's in the feeling. So you have a kind of on-ramp to subjectivism when it comes to beauty. Hume also highlights usefulness. You know, he highlights, I would say, usefulness more than any other factor in what influences our sense of beauty. yet at the same time, he didn't experience the Bauhaus movement, you know, yeah, in yeah. architecture and in furniture, which is just nothing but utility, no frills. And I don't think Hume would appreciate yeah. that or like that. I mean, so, you know, Hume is more, I mean, he would certainly long for a middle ground there. Yet at the same time, by grounding, you know, beauty in perception, you have once again, right, like an on-ramp to a kind of subjectivism, which I'll tell this story. When I was at Princeton as a James Madison fellow, my sister-in-law visited. And you being on Princeton's campus, it's one of the most beautiful campuses, you know, in the country, if not the most beautiful. And that neo-Gothic style is great. But then there are a lot of ugly buildings, you know, newer buildings that are a disgrace. And so my sister-in-law visited. She was, I think, high school, college at the time. And she said, just a throwaway comment, beauty is subjective. And I said, I can't believe that someone staying in my house would express this, and this is unacceptable. So I had her watch Roger Scruton's documentary on beauty, and we had a conversation about it afterwards. Thankfully, she sat through it. And then I walked on Princeton's campus, and I said, look at this side, look at this building, look at this new dorm hall. Okay, which one is beautiful and which one is ugly? And anyway, I think I got the point through to her. But Hume similar to Francis Hutcheson or Lord Shaftesbury. They were moral sentimentalists who thought beauty was also grounded in taste. Like they used them analogously. They were similar. They served similar functions. So Hume's concerned with beauty, definitely. So I don't want to, misrepresent Hume. And it's worthwhile, I think. Of the standard of taste is worth looking at.
Interesting. Yeah, I know it. Being a Protestant, I was really only exposed to all this beauty discourse relatively recently. So it sounds like I should probably also check out. I did not know that there was a Roger Scruton documentary. So that's
oh my goodness. That's well, good yes, absolutely. Check it out. You can find it on YouTube.
Yeah. So I think it's come up a couple times that Hume was an empiricist and this really kind of hardcore reliance on the senses. It's in a way, it's kind of a basic question, but it seems to me like the senses are very easily fooled. I mean, I think a lot of us have had the experience of a kid of realizing that just because soap smells good does not mean that it tastes good. And yes, this is like, yes. It's like a revelation. but no, it's really very easy to fool all of your senses, your eyes, your taste, and your mind. So can you unpack a little bit, why Hume thought that?
Yes. This is very good. I mean, Hume is very much concerned with what is trustworthy. Like, what do we trust? Can we trust our reason? Can we trust our senses? And even back to the ancient philosophical debate, this is what the Stoics were saying to the Epicureans, you know, and the Epicureans were acknowledging, well, you cover one eye and then it's, you know, things look different. You put something in water, it looks different. The moon looks one size, you know, according to sight. And so this was very much on the minds of anybody who is putting their trust in the senses. Now Hume, he starts his Treatise of Human Nature, which was published around the time he's 28 years old. And the first book of the treatise is Hume, approaching his reason skeptically and saying, okay, can I rationally justify my belief in the uniformity of nature, in the external and continued existence of objects, in my belief in myself? And he comes to the conclusion that he cannot. And so he's just distraught. He's philosophical melancholy and delirium.
This is exactly what I experienced. Yeah, when I put soap in my mouth as a kid.
exactly.
And basically so, the same.
And so his solution is, well, to go out into the world, you know, just not think overly hard on these things. And essentially he continues his reasoning on the passions by trusting that which nature presents as necessary, like natural beliefs that you just have to believe in, and you believe them by habit. And that is, you know, belief in the existence of the self, belief in external objects. So someone like Pierre Bayle, who Hume read a lot, a skeptic, a French skeptic, one-time Protestant, one-time Catholic, Protestant again, in the middle of the religious wars, had a hard time. He said, what do I trust in? I can't trust my reason. I can't trust my senses. I'm going to trust in scripture, in divine revelation. Hume, he says, I'm going to trust nature. Now, I mean, you get to it like, and it's a kind of trial and error, right? Like, yeah, soap tastes bad, you know? But there are certain things that he does trust, and it's just like that which is necessary for life. Because he's thinking, like, you'll just be perplexed and amazed if you try to rationally justify everything. So what in common life, where can we find agreement, what works? So, I mean, there's a, you know, there's a kind of empiricism, a kind of nascent pragmatism here.
Interesting. So I want to move on to talking a little bit more about kind of the strictly political side. And first of all, you referred kind of towards the beginning of this conversation to Hume and Montesquieu being really frequently quoted by the founders. I'll just put it really, really bluntly. Do we live in a Humean republic?
That's a complex question.
The ones always are. That's
yeah, cool. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I gave an exam to my students the other day, and there was three prompts, and they had to choose two to write short essays on. And the shortest prompt was definitely the most difficult one. Yeah. So they probably looked at that. Oh, short question. That's easy. No, not easy at all. Now, James Madison, you might have heard of him. I don't know. So when he was there at Princeton.
Friend of a friend.
That's right. That other friend being John Witherspoon, of course, whose statue is out there on Princeton's campus.
So far,
yes. I'll stand out there. I'll stand in front of that statue with him if it comes down to it. So Witherspoon was Madison's teacher, and Witherspoon was someone who he mentioned Hume. And he critiqued Hume, and he included Hume on an extracurricular reading list, but he did not teach Hume.
Interesting. Right?
He disagreed with some other Scottish Enlightenment thinkers, but he definitely was, more on the orthodox side of things in religion and morals. And so Madison, he would have known his Hume. We have good evidence that he read Hume early on. He definitely read Hume before the Constitutional Convention. And I think Hume drew a good bit of inspiration from some of the political elements of Madison drew inspiration from some of Hume's doctrines on politics. And some of those are relying on experience and observation in political life, like what regimes have been tried before, what political forms have been tried before, and what have we learned from them? Madison certainly thinks that is a viable methodology, and it's exhibited in the Federalist Papers. Madison thinks that, along with Hume, that parties or factions are inevitable, and balancing these factions in a large republic is a good option for, if not curing their mischiefs and minimizing them. And so, this idea of the expanded republic and drawing wisdom from history, Madison takes those on board. But the moral doctrines and the religious doctrines, Madison does not rely on, nor does he necessarily need to rely on them, right, in the Federalist Papers, which is a defense of the constitutional structure. So I think all of those authors of the Federalist Papers are more moral rationalists than empiricists. So, and they're not really sentimentalists either. So I think there's more work to be done, which I do plan to do on where the founding generation drew their guidance on moral philosophical matters. And they certainly did so from the more orthodox Scottish Enlightenment thinkers, not the more radical Hume.
Hume makes another really interesting observation that I'd be remiss if I didn't mention, but that there's a difference between parties of interest and parties of principle. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about that, because I think I read that and I was like, oh, that I found something in this book that feels very prophetic. That feels like that's currently kind of working itself out in a lot of places in the world.
Yeah. That's, I mean, one very interesting thing is, you know, Hume's responding to enthusiasm in religion in particular. And so he's trying to moderate that. And now, you know, enthusiasm in the present day is more philosophical, or, you know, is at his heart religious, as John McWhorter might say. But you also see this trend, you know, drawing back from that extreme. And Hume said that enthusiasm in philosophy is never as dangerous as enthusiasm in religion. Now, I think he might change his mind now if you were looking at society today. And so one thing underlying this distinction between parties of interest and of principle, he's thinking of interest in primarily economic terms, and he's looking at principle as the guiding doctrines of the parties in his day, which for the Whigs was the original contract, and for the Tories was passive obedience. And so, I think one good example of Hume's perspective is he sees during the Glorious Revolution, you know, even the Tories, who prefer monarchy, believe in passive obedience, you know, are dedicated to the Stuart regime, even they compromised in the establishment of a limited monarchy and a Protestant Hanoverian succession, because they, you know, Hume essentially says, you know, they loved liberty and peace, you know, and order more than they were dedicated to their principles. So this is, I think, an example for Hume, right? When I mentioned before, like, what can you trust? Hume is saying, well, what you can trust are the common needs and interests in public life, right? Like those necessities, focus on those and we're going to be okay. And so he thought when you have the intrusion of principle, you have disorder, you have impediments to compromise, you have, you know, rioting, you have, you know, these sort of things that are undesirable. So when Hume is seeing, he sees the balance of liberty and authority in society, is there's this constant balance that you're trying to strike. And toward the end of his life, he's looking at, you know, election controversies and riots resulting from them. This might sound familiar, but he says, you know, this is too much liberty. Liberty is the perfection of civil society, but authority is needed for its maintenance and preservation. And, you know, we might be seeing some of that today. Like, let's, you know, principles, abstract principles, especially when they're detached from biological reality and, sound principles. See, now Hume can help us from the other side here.
Yeah, and Hume, I mean, you've kind of made a couple of references to the sort of how liberal versus conservative is Hume debate.
Yes.
And that's super interesting to me, because it does seem like right now in our national politics, we're also in a transition period where a lot of people who were considered very liberal are suddenly staunchly on the conservative team. I think Barry Weiss is one really famous example, also like Jordan Peterson and Jonathan Haidt and a lot of kind of public thinkers have also had that evolution. Do you think it would be fair to say that the reasons why Hume has kind of went back and forth a little bit from being considered a liberal to being a conservative are similar?
Yeah, this is an outstanding observation. And, you know, I do think, you know, Hume's trajectory, you know, towards a more conservative political outlook, and then the trajectory of some of these figures that you mentioned, I think that they're very similar. So Hume is someone who likes progress. I mean, he has a kind of progressive view of history and his history of England. You know, he says the modern ages can't really or the ancient age is not really useful. It's only the modern ages that can really educate us and inform us how to act and how to live and how to think. And so one scholar said, you know, for a historian, he seems to hate history. You know, someone who looks back and sort of disregards a lot of it as useless and only some of it is as useful. So, I mean, Hume looks back at barbaric ages, at, you know, Christendom and feudalism, and those are, right, like, that's all backwardness. Those are the benighted ages, and we have to move forward. Yet, Hume sort of reaches this point, and he sees it in the post-1688 establishment in England, and he ends his history in 1688. So it's like progress here and no further is sort of how I read Hume. And so this is, I mean, helpful in some ways. It recognizes, you know, the need for moderation and appreciation of present gains. Right? Like civilization is delicate. We're imperfect beings. Utopia is not achievable. Let's preserve gains and prevent, you know, backsliding. Like that's part of a conservative disposition, I think. Now, I mean, this is evident in, you know, Jonathan Haidt in his book, The Righteous Mind. It's a Humean moral perspective that he takes.
Yes, I was actually, it's funny because I was reading the section on virtue and thinking that, and then I was like, maybe this is too specific to bring up in the interview.
No, it's, but and I think it's telling. And so it's a great observation on your part that there's this recovery of, you know, morality, conceiving of it as a matter of taste and feeling, and more so than reason, right? Jonathan Haidt says we tend to rationally justify whatever our viewpoints are. And so, you know, public debate has limited, you know, limited effect on these views. Now, I think that that's part of the conservative outlook. My concern, though, and I'm very interested in thinking about this question, what is conservatism? And that's primarily a negative vision. So I think a kind of Humean conservatism is negative insofar as it's devoted to, you know, stopping further progress, right? So it's and a lot of people criticize conservatism for being, you know, just anti this, anti that. So what could be a more positive vision for conservatives to have? And I think that there is a more positive vision, more positive civilizational vision that sees conservatism as really a defense of the great tradition. The resources provided by Greek philosophy, Roman law, and Hebrew and Christian religion. And so there, this isn't regime specific. It's civilizationally and culturally oriented, but it recognizes those fountains from which, you know, our civilization springs. A civilization, as Cicero mentioned, was devoted to humanitas, or the cultivation of distinctly human capacities, those that separate us from the beasts. And so you have, right, there is a vision of the noble, there is a vision of transcendence, of immutable moral principles, and of a constant and universal human nature, and a transcendent and accessible natural law that is over and above political law, human law, and that can orient those laws and direct us toward a happy and safe and peaceful and prosperous social life. I mean, that is, I think, that serves as the starting point for a positive vision of what conservatism can be. And I think it's one that we ought to embrace, because it's only so long that you can say, you know, that you can be anti-woke, or that you can be anti-progressive, or that you can, you know, try to stop some of these trends. I mean, I think it's necessary to have a positive vision. And, you know, I think that's where Hume falls short. But that's an opportunity to see, okay, what aspects of conservatism does Hume articulate that we can draw upon, and where does he fall short in our time period? Where can we go to deepen our our moral and political framework. And I think we can find it in precisely that classical Christian tradition, with Socrates as one of the fountainheads, and Jerusalem, the Hebrew and Christian religion, as the other one.
Okay, very last question. It does seem like there's quite a lot that you disagree with Hume about. And it's sort of interesting that then that is kind of your academic focus, someone with whom you disagree so mightily. What about Hume draws you to him? And what does he say that you think is actually true and worth preserving?
Wonderful. It is. I've had a strange relationship with Hume. So he's a great thinker. Mm-hmm. He's a great writer. He's influential. I mean, if you're thinking two major figures who present opposing views in the history of philosophy, if you just look at Aristotle and Hume, you're going to develop a pretty good understanding and foundation of your options philosophically. I'll let you guess which side I side with. But one thing that he says that is true, I mean, this is good because he says so much. I remember, you know, sharing with my father, he's asking me about Hume, and I look at my shelf of all these Hume books and I say, why did I choose someone who wrote so much? But I think it's his tireless pursuit of truth. I mean, he does say, when he has this bout of philosophical melancholy and delirium, you know, I mean, philosophizing led him to this. Hmm. And then he goes out and he plays some backgammon. He has a dinner party, goes for a walk. He's feeling a little better. And he says, I can't quit the treatise after book one. I want to find the principles of good and evil, of just and unjust, of human nature. Like, I can't stop. And so he has this part where he mentions, like, there, it's part of human nature to pursue these truths. And so, I mean, I think that's where Hume and I are, you know, in agreement, is you can't stop that pursuit of truth. You can't even fully privatize it. It's going on privately, publicly, constantly. There's no action or thought, no thought that we have, no action that we take that is not oriented by our view of the world and human nature and God's relation with it. And so Hume has made me a better thinker and writer, I hope. And so he provides good company. But as Abigail Adams said, beware.
Well, that is a fantastic note to end on. Thank you so much for your time, Aaron. I learned so much in this conversation.
Thank you. It was a great conversation.
Well, there you have it, Madisonians. Aaron Zuvia on his new book, The Political Thought of David Hume. It's linked in the show notes, and I'd absolutely encourage you to go check it out. If you enjoyed this episode, you can find out more about the Madison program and what we do here on Princeton's campus at jmp.princeton.edu. There, you can find recordings of all of our previous lectures, as well as a schedule of our upcoming events. You can join our email list, and you can also find us on social media, on Twitter at Madison Program, as well as on Instagram and Facebook. Finally, if you enjoyed this episode, we really appreciate any and all ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts. It really does help us a lot. Again, thank you so much for tuning in, and I'll see you next week here on Madison's Notes.